Question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just
a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a weekly digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's July 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It's chilling up my spine.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
Bin Laden's driver is tried in military court for terrorism. A U.S.-India nuclear deal sparks instability in the Indian parliament. And Puerto Rico's teachers struggle for labor rights and quality education.
When the fellow mellows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Hello and welcome to Uprising. Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a father of two from Yemen, is standing trial in Guantanamo, Cuba, for participating in a terrorism conspiracy and faces life in prison if convicted. Prosecutors are portraying Osama bin Laden's former driver as a member of Al-Qaeda who supported terrorist attacks and was an accomplice to the September 11, 2001 attacks. But Hamdan's lawyers say he was a salaried employee who never joined Al-Qaeda or even shared bin Laden's views. The case against Hamdan is the first U.S. military commission trial since World War II and is being seen as the first test of military justice. Last Monday, a military judge threw out some of the prosecution's evidence, saying that it was obtained under highly coercive conditions while he was held captive in Afghanistan. In fact, Hamdan's lawyers say he was beaten, abused, and tortured while in Guantanamo. About 20 more cases are scheduled to be heard by military rather than civilian juries. In 2006, the Supreme Court struck down the military commission system after Hamdan's lawyers filed suit, but Congress overrode the ruling by passing the Military Commissions Act of 2006, under which Hamdan is being tried now. My guest is Hina Shamsi. She is an attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. So first, let's talk about the constitutionality of the military commission system itself. Does Congress's Act of Military Commissions Act of 2006, under this context, is what's happening to Hamdan constitutional?
It is not. There are a number of provisions in the Military Commissions Act that are unconstitutional. And to understand that and to understand why, you've got to remember that the administration's goal in setting up Guantanamo and in creating a place for detainees to be held outside of the United States was to create a legal black hole, to avoid judicial review at all costs. And you mentioned earlier the Hamdan case in the Supreme Court in 2006, in which the Supreme Court essentially told the administration, you can't do that. The Military Commissions Act was heavily, heavily influenced by the administration. And the entire purpose of the legislation was to justify and to retroactively permit what had already occurred at Guantanamo. The new legislation is ill-conceived. For the very first time in American history, it includes provisions that permit coerced evidence to be used at trial. It permits hearsay presumptively. It allows the government to use secret evidence in preparing its case, which the defense and defense attorneys and the defendant himself may not have access to. And so essentially, the Military Commissions Act creates a system that is far more generous to the government than the regular military or criminal justice system and far more weighted towards conviction.
What about the fact that the military judge on Monday threw out some evidence that he says was obtained under coercive methods? Is that a sign that this could potentially be a fair system?
Well, certainly the judge's decision, this is Judge Allred in Mr. Hamdan's case, is a very welcome one. But it's too little and too late, because the framework of the system under which the trials are being conducted is in itself illegitimate. The framework is weighted for the reasons I'd laid out earlier and for a number of other sort of reasons to do with the unfairness of the provisions and the weight that they give to the government. The framework is weighted against a fair trial. Mr. Hamdan's case, like those of other Guantanamo detainees accused of war crimes, should take place in an ordinary federal court or in a traditional military court under tried, true, and reliable rules of evidence and procedural due process and substantive rights.
What do you mean by traditional military court?
Well, in the appropriate circumstances, the laws of war provide that a country may use its own courts-martial system to try people it finds to be who violated the laws of war. Now, that is one of the reasons that the Supreme Court struck down the first iteration of the military commissions that the Bush administration had created, because they found that the military commissions violated the laws of war as well as a provision of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is what governs military courts-martial in the United States, that required the procedures to be fair and in accordance with rights that are fundamental as recognized by civilized people.
You know, it seems as though this system has been set up. I mentioned Hamdan is being seen as a test case for these military trials, these new kind of military trials. It seems as though this entire system is essentially set up to come to an inevitable conclusion. I mean, there's no way politically that the jury, the military jury, would let Hamdan walk. If they did, it would be a huge political uproar. And so it seems as though that all of this is very politicized. The court is essentially a kangaroo court, and that it doesn't seem as though there's any way Hamdan could get a fair trial. I mean, I don't know if that's sort of an accurate summary or not.
I think it is very hard. I think it's impossible under this system for Hamdan to receive a fair trial, and I completely agree with you that it is a system that is heavily, heavily politicized. The extent to which it is politicized and the extent to which it is unfair, I think, is most demonstrated by the fact that the military and the administration has taken the position that even if the military jury were to find Mr. Hamdan not guilty, the administration would continue to be able to hold him and not release him until what it says are the end of hostilities, something that is absolutely not defined and you know, could lead to further indefinite and arbitrary detention above and beyond the 6 years that have already applied to Mr. Hamdan.
Are you referring to the result of the Al-Mari case recently?
No, I'm not, although that's another you know, problematic outcome. No, I'm referring to government statements that regardless of the outcome, the government, the administration has the right to detain people as enemy combatants based on the president's unilateral designation of them as such.
Hina Shamsi is my guest. She's an attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. And Hina, the Attorney General Michael Mukasey called on Congress just this week to authorize indefinite detention. I think that's maybe what you were referring to with respect to the Hamdan case, regardless of the outcome of Hamdan's trial?
Yes, the Attorney General did, in fact, ask Congress to authorize detention in the context of, but also spoke about what the content of habeas proceedings for the U.S., for the Guantanamo detainees ought to be. And in essence, the Attorney General asked Congress to expand and extend the war on terror forever. He, you know, essentially put forward a position that would permit this president or the next one to declare someone a terrorist, including U.S. citizens, and then hold them indefinitely without a trial. One of the other deeply problematic aspects of what the Attorney General proposed Congress should do is not permit Guantanamo detainees to raise what are called their conditions of confinement claim. Essentially, that means that they would not be able to put before an independent court The fact of what happened to them when they were in U.S. custody, either in Guantanamo or Afghanistan or wherever else they were held before being brought to Guantanamo.
And on that note, Hamdan's lawyers are making the case that he was abused, beaten, tortured, had systematic sleep deprivation during his time both in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo. The defenders of the military commission system say that, well, there are safeguards to allowing evidence from torture. But then there's this whole thing about the semantics of what is considered torture versus harsh interrogation, quote unquote. How do you see that argument and the debate over torture, sad that it is even a debate, playing into the Hamdan case?
I think it's going to be a large part of the case, has already been a large part of the case, and frankly, it is going to be the underlying theme of any of the military commission cases because of the now undisputable record of the administration's systematic use of policies and procedures to authorize torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and the extent to which I think it will permeate the case. As you noted, the defense is challenging evidence in Mr. Hamdan's trial because of the abuse that he suffered in Guantanamo. Just right before trial, the government handed over to defense lawyers approximately 600 pages of information that showed that, for example, Mr. Hamdan had been part of a program in which the government exposed him to sleep deprivation, including waking him every hour for approximately 50 days in 2003. There is no way that torture and coercion of the Guantanamo detainees and the Guantanamo detainees who were held in secret CIA custody as well is not going to be permeated by the torture question.
Hina, finally, let's put this into broad context, specifically about Salim Ahmed Hamdan. This man, supposedly a driver of Osama bin Laden, is the first test case for the Bush administration. It's like if somebody was trying to try George W. Bush for high crimes, but instead starting with the person who takes out his trash, instead of and using that as fair game in terms of prosecuting him. I mean, putting it into context, does it seem to you as though Hamdan is essentially a very low level scapegoat for what are the likely the crimes of a much more elusive more directly culpable individual that the Bush administration has claimed they've been looking for and failed to find?
I think that Mr. Hamdan's trial very much is a test case. The administration is trying out its theories. It's going to see how much and how far its extremely broad definition of what constitutes an enemy combatant and who is a quote-unquote supporter of terrorism, how far the government policies will fly in court, and that's one of the tests of these military commissions, because specifically with respect to Mr. Hamdan, his lawyers say that he was a driver and a mechanic who did a job for a paycheck, not because of ideals. And in fact, his lawyers say that if they get access to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that they have information that would show that Mr. Hamdan actually was ordered to drive women and children away from the battlefield. So this, very low-level guy being used as a test case for a system, I think just goes to show you how intellectually and morally bankrupt the system is and how deeply problematic it is that 6 years after Mr. Hamdan was captured, he is only being brought to trial now, and the bigger alleged people responsible for the larger crimes have yet to be brought to trial. And that is the consequence of deviating from, again, the tried and true federal criminal justice system, which would have permitted these trials to take place fairly in the eyes both of the American public and of the world.
I've been speaking with Hina Shamsi, an attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project, and for more information, you can visit aclu.org. Later in the hour, we'll be joined in studio by three leaders of the largest independent union in Puerto Rico, which is the Teachers Union. We'll also hear this week's Black Agenda report about Afghanistan. And we'll go to India to talk to Badri Rena about what just happened in the Indian Parliament, sparked by the U.S. nuclear deal with India. You're listening to Uprising. We're on the web at uprisingradio.org. Up next, we'll hear a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist and political prisoner. Today's commentary is about the media coverage of elections.
Beyond elections. If TV news channels are any measure, the U.S. presidential elections, now less than 4 months away, are the permanent stuff of headlines. If candidate A sneezes, it's breaking news. If candidate B hiccups, it's film at 11. It's hardly worthy of headlines, but the beast must be fed. For far too many people, this news overdose on the elections has bred a kind of passivity among millions as they wait in front of TV screens and computers like deer caught in headlights. What happened to anti-war protests? What happened to housing rights protesters? What happened to anti-FISA activists? People are dulled by the almost sure expectation that Democrats will prevail in the next election due to the low ratings of the Republican Party and President Bush. And those dull expectations are based upon the totally unfounded faith that a Democratic win of the White House really means an end to the war. Millions have forgotten the bitter lesson from the midterm elections when Democrats prevailed in congressional elections, formed a majority in both houses, and proceeded to do nothing. Peace in Iraq? Off the table. Instead, like lemmings leaping off a cliff, they voted for more and more billions for war. And what of FISA, or the expanded Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which legalized the law-breaking of the Bush administration and gave retroactive protection to phone and communications companies, which violated prior law. FISA signed, sealed, and delivered. And even the Democratic candidate who blasted the bill signed it into law. Elections aren't endings. They are beginnings. And movements mustn't stop moving. They should continue to protest more. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Listen to Mumia Abu-Jamal's audio commentaries online at www.prisonradio.org. A nuclear deal between India and the United States has sparked serious instability within the Indian government. After more than 3 years of negotiations over a U.S.-India nuclear agreement, the Indian Parliament recently held a vote of confidence in the coalition government led by the Congress Party. The narrowly won vote was called by Prime Minister Manmohan Singh after the two leftist parties pulled their support of the U.S.-India nuclear deal, saying that it would make India subservient to U.S. policy. If the deal goes through, it would ostensibly provide India with access to American civilian nuclear technology in exchange for nuclear-armed India agreeing to oversight by the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. The deal, as it's simply called in India today, is a legacy builder for Manmohan Singh, with one reporter claiming no Indian prime minister has ever staked his government's future so completely and so unilaterally like Mr. Singh has. The confidence vote was so close that six parliamentarians currently serving prison sentences for various crimes were temporarily freed to take part in the vote. Lawmakers recovering from illnesses and even surgery were flown in. Emotions ran high, with the chief minister of one state, Uttar Pradesh, claiming that the deal makes India, quote, a slave of the United States. The Bush administration is keen on finalizing the nuclear deal before the president's tenure ends at the end of the year. My guest is Badri Rena. He's a former professor at Delhi University, a prolific writer, and a columnist for ZNet, and he joined us on the phone from New Delhi. Thank you very much for joining us. So it turns out that the result is that the Indian government won the confidence vote?
Yes, that's true. A difference of 19 and 10 abstaining. But I must also say that this is a very, very dark day for parliamentary democracy in India, because just after the speeches were over, three BJP MPs with very shady backgrounds, who have earlier had difficulties in money laundering and things like that, produced a sum of 3 crores in Parliament House and accused the opposition, where in this case the government phalange, of actually bribing them.
And the BJP is the Bharatiya Janata Party, which used to be in power.
That's right. That's right. The opposition BJP. And we don't know exactly what is the backdrop to this. The speaker, of course, called a meeting of all the party leaders, and I think we'll go into a probe. And at this point, it is very, very difficult to say what will come out. But altogether, yes, the government has won the vote. Where it will go from here seems obvious enough now. You ask me what you want to ask.
Well, the vote seemed to be a sort of make or break thing for the Prime Minister and his party. What led him to stake so much on this vote?
Yes. That's a good question. Actually, let me put it this way, into some context. You see, beginning 1990, you remember the Washington Consensus?
Mm-hmm.
There has been a paradigm shift in India's economic policy and economic thinking. Consider that after the anti-colonial movement, India was to actually give to itself what was called a mixed economy, with the state controlling what Nehru called the commanding heights of the economy. And the state it was that gave to India its educational institutions in science, technology, research, universities, and some of the early bourgeoisie was a national bourgeoisie, which was severely protected by the state against foreign competition and so on and so forth. Now, one of the reasons, of course, this was that India was a very poor country. When we speak now in 2008, what is it, July 22, mm-hmm. please remember that according to a report of a committee set up by this government, this is called the Arjun Sengupta Committee, a very well-known economist and member of Parliament of the Congress. The committee, in a fairly detailed report, among other things, produced the finding that as of now, 77% Indians subsist on a daily expenditure of 20 rupees, that's 50 cents, or less. 77% Indians. On the other hand of the spectrum, you have, in 2003, we already had 26 billionaires, and over the last 3 or 4 years, that has gone up to 46 billionaires. And other classes that were spawned by the economic reforms of 1990, when the present Prime Minister was the Finance Minister. This was the beginning of the neoliberal economic phase in Indian policy making. Now, after all these 20 years, India has spawned a new middle class. And this is a middle class. There's, of course, a generational shift also. India has among the world's largest population of young people, below 25 or something. Now, this is since I'm talking to Radio Uprising, this is an uprisen class which has very faint memories of the anti-colonial freedom movement, which has a social conscience which is non-existent, if you ask me, and whose principal dream is to fulfill the Indian-American dream. I've called it so in one of my articles. Big superpower claims and so on and so forth. Now, this, of course, was aided greatly by the policy that Rajiv Gandhi, the late Rajiv Gandhi, initiated in the IT sector. And as you know today, in the IT services sector, India controls something like 60% of world trade. Now, therefore, after that economic paradigm shift, there has been this consuming desire for another kind of economic shift, which is to go away from non-alignment, Brussels, Beijing, Bandung, and so on, to align with what they think is unqualified terms, the world's only remaining unilateral superpower, namely the United States of America. Regardless of Bush or his ratings or what he has been doing in the world, and supported massively by this very influential NRI segment.
The non-resident Indian segment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the non-resident Indians in America. And therefore, they have been arguing, you know, it's time to forget about the old world Nehruvian social conscience. By the way, the preamble of the Indian Constitution also has the word secular and socialist democracy, which is now a bit of a joke. And to go full forward to register new GDP growth, new departures in technology, and this is a massively consumerist upper middle class, with the income disparities, which as I suggested to you, are absolutely mind-boggling. Now, therefore, doesn't matter the inflation is double-digit today, doesn't matter the prices are skyrocketing of foodstuffs and so on, doesn't matter the poor people have no health care, have no insurance, doesn't matter that 95% of the laboring belong to the unorganized sector in India. And they have absolutely, they're completely out of any kind of network, social network, or social security network. It doesn't matter. These things will take care of themselves. Of course, this thinking is also, Sonali, you must understand, in India's very peculiar cultural history, it's also aided very much by another kind of philosophical challenge, which is this whole karma theory. In other words, we've had our own variety of Hindu to Calvinism, as I've called it somewhere or the other, which is to say that, you know, after all, people come and bring with them their own past karmas, and the government can do only so much. And we have been in the middle of a phase, free tradeism, 19th century England, where the theory is that the state has no business in corporate life, except, as in your case currently, what is that, Freddie May and something?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Yeah, Fannie Mae or whatever and so on. When the corporates are down in the dumps and need help, then, of course, the state must come forward. But otherwise, the state must leave the corporates and business activity completely free. And if profit margins are maximizing, skyrocketing, all the better. Should any of that go into welfare activity? Well, Nehru thought so, but we don't think so. And this is the way to go. And a third aspect to this, of course, is the military aspect. Now, I would say that from day one, Manmohan Singh and the corporate India that supports this government, and on the one side, and the left on the other side, have been very clear from day one that the nuclear deal or civilian nuclear deal arrangement and so on is really not about the civilian nuclear deal arrangement. They've been clear from day one. The left, as you know, does its homework. And they understood that this was, of course, an attempt for the first time openly and unabashedly to draw India into what they call a strategic partnership with the United States. Of course, there were other, which had other aspects to it, as you must have read, this whole notion of, and some of that is in the Hyde Act, that there will be closed military cooperation in the South Seas, the quadrilateral thing that they call it, Australia, Japan, America, India. Of course, for America, this is a wonderful way of obtaining some kind of hegemonic hold in this part of the world. And there will be interoperability in terms of military controls to a point where a document also suggests that in order to make that possible, they will wear the same uniforms as U.S. soldiers. And of course, and the other factors, whenever Allied forces, read American forces, need space here, need facilities here to go to attack this country or that country, then of course those would be made available. This is all documented.
So, Badri, basically what has led to this confidence vote today that the government of India narrowly won is a trend towards wanting to become more and more aligned with, as you've said, the world's only superpower, the United
yes.
States. Of course, this has sparked this enormous debate within India that goes even beyond the nuclear deal itself. What about the position that civil society, particularly those on the left, are taking? And I'm not talking about the communist parties who are in government, but people on the streets, organized the organized left on the streets. What position do they take on the U.S. nuclear deal?
Well, the interesting thing is, you see, the answer to that is very complicated. There is the organized left, as you know, the communist parties which participate in parliamentary democracy. Then, of course, there's the left that is not part of the parliamentary system, which is involved in anti-state military activity and spreading through various states. We call them the Naxalites or the Maoists. That's the other left.
The Maoists, uh-huh.
Then there is left liberals like me, if you like, who recognize that there is so much and no more that you can do under a certain circumstance, and there are objective conditions in history. But at the least, one would expect that there would be some Keynesian economics, there would be some welfare economics, there would be a role for the state, there would be a more equitable distribution of wealth and investments in the social sector, and so on. And it is because of the pressure from the left, which has been supporting this government for 4 years or more, that you have had schemes over the last year, which, you know, if you look at them independently, have been quite astounding. I mean, the only place in the world where you have a scheme where employment for 100 days is guaranteed to one member of every family who need employment. This is called the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme. It's quite astounding. At a time when jobs are cut everywhere in the world, this probably is the only country where this happened, and it's working. Now, this has resulted in stymieing the migration of populations that used to take place from the Mufassils and the upcountry towards the major towns and so on. It's had remarkable dividends, undoubtedly. Similarly, there have been other schemes like Bharat Nirman, road schemes, irrigation schemes, increasingly schemes for the minorities, despite fierce, as you know, opposition from the communal fascists. All that because largely the left was supporting this government. Whereas elites, civil society, allied to the corporates, have been screaming that you should get rid of these people, and because they are holding up reforms. By reforms, we know what they mean. Privatize education, privatize services, privatize everything. Because the Washington Consensus at the heart of it had one simple point in a detailed document, which was the transfer of wealth from public hands to private hands. Now, this has been held back because of the dependence of the left. And the minute they won the vote, I was listening, and you have the channels, corporate channels. India has a whole host of them now. For example, CNN, IBN, and such like, who have been saying, thank God, now the left is gone and you have won the vote. Okay, deal is okay, but now you can go full steam and do all the reforms you ever wanted to do. Now, then there is another kind of civil society, which is NGOs, non-governmental organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there you have a very peculiar picture. They do wonderful work, no doubt. But it is the kind of work which is discreet and disparate in a postmodernist type of way. You know, somebody is doing dams and somebody is doing ecology, and somebody's doing some irrigation somewhere, and so on. And nothing really seems to tie them together. Their connect with the organized left has been really non-existent, largely, because of turf wars, also because of the left's organized left's inability, I think, to democratize itself, as it could have over the years. I've written about that also. Because also sometimes questions are asked about this kind of civil society, its funding, its vested interests, what it actually does and doesn't do. Various government commissions have gone into this question. This constitutes roughly about 20% of India's population, this whole gamut. The rest, as I said, 77%, are people who are laboring, who are either in the farm sector or in the unorganized sector, unorganized services sector, or in the mills, which are increasingly closing down. Then there is a middle section, like the BPOs, who live off outsourced jobs. And then there is the corporate elite.
Right. I've been speaking with Badri Rana, a former professor at Delhi University, a prolific writer and a columnist for ZNet. You can read his articles online at zmag.org/z/Badri Rana. That's BADRIRAINA. You are listening to Uprising. We're on the web at uprisingradio.org. And after this week's Black Agenda report, we'll hear from Puerto Rican teachers about the repression that they have faced in their struggle for labor rights and quality education. Stay tuned. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about Afghanistan.
The United States has a long history of wiping out wedding parties in Afghanistan and Iraq. The latest atrocity killed 49 guests at a wedding festivity, 39 of them women and children, according to an Afghan government investigation. While the Americans initially insisted that only male militants were killed in the bombing raid. This is the usual story. Despite all its smart weapons, the U.S. periodically wipes out most of at least two extended families gathered for a matrimonial celebration in occupied countries. One can only conclude that wedding parties are tempting targets, what with the music playing, the bright and colorful ceremonial clothing, the dancing, the singing. What brave American pilot could resist locking on to such an attractive bullseye? There could hardly be a less threatening event than a wedding party, which is why it's so important to note every time the Americans blow one up. The crime, mass murder from the air, points up the casually racist nature of the U.S. occupations of both Afghanistan and Iraq. These homicides, these acts of depraved indifference to human life, reveal the occupiers' true attitude towards the native, that they are like roaches to be squashed on sight. In the case of the latest wedding party massacre, a high-level official in the American-imposed Afghan regime reported that the families had nothing to do with the Taliban. But what if they did? Would it be all right for the Americans to burn and obliterate families whose members are sympathetic to the Taliban? No, that would be a crime against humanity under international law. Yet the U.S. occupiers murder civilians with abandon every day in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they are cloaked in immunity, not by law, because nothing can immunize soldiers against war crimes and crimes against humanity, but by American brute force. In Baghdad, American soldiers and mercenaries think nothing of shooting their way out of traffic jams that naturally occur in a city larger than Chicago. The penalty for getting too close to an American vehicle as one commutes to and from one's job in Baghdad is death. And of course, all deaths at the hands of the Americans are justifiable. This is the nature of occupation, especially when the occupier comes from a racist country. By official count, Hundreds of civilians have been killed in Afghanistan this year. The real number is certainly much higher, since the Americans, to put it bluntly, routinely lie about their crimes. The body count has become an extreme embarrassment to puppet President Hamid Karzai, who is helpless to do anything about it. Meanwhile, the Americans do what they do best, make enemies. They accomplish this without effort because they arrive in the country pre-programmed to treat the natives like vermin. The United States is proud that it makes the smartest bombs in the world. Then it behaves like a nation of dumb racist murderers and wonders why people hate the name America. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. Welcome back to Uprising. The highly organized teachers of Puerto Rico have faced violent repression in their fight for labor rights and quality education. The Federación de Maestros de Puerto Rico, or FMPR, represents over 40,000 teachers and is the largest independent union in Puerto Rico. In February of this year, teachers voted to strike after working without a contract for 30 months. Their historic 10-day strike was met with police action and over a dozen arrests. The FMPR's main opposition is Governor Aníbal Acevedo Vila, whose government decertified the union in retaliation for voting to strike. Now, leaders of the FMPR are on a national tour of the United States with the intention to, quote, build solidarity with teachers and communities about what it will take to win quality education for all students, as well as to build a truly progressive labor movement. My guests are Rafael Feliciano Hernandez, he is the president of FMPR, and Luis Santiago, the executive board member of the organization, as well as Ana Serrano, vice president of the Aguadilla local of FMPR. First, let's talk about the 10-day strike that took place in February. Why was it historic, and what was the result of the strike? What was the outcome, Rafael?
Well, we developed a 10-day strike in last February. It's very important and it's a historical process because between 23 to 26,000 of teachers go to the strike. Most of them were women and were teachers of the elementary level. And I think that is a very important process for us in Puerto Rico. You know that we are a colony of U.S. No Child Left Behind is also in Puerto Rico, making a big damage to our educational system, and the community, the teachers, make a joint effort against the government and the intention of the government to privatize schools using charter schools and so things, cosas como esa. We stop that. We make an agreement to stop a charter school in Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, they cannot develop charter school, actually. And also we gain the respect of the community and of the people of Puerto Rico. And we fight not only for our teachers' issues, also we fight for a good education for all the our people in Puerto Rico because we have very bad condition in our schools.
Let's talk first about the conditions of the teachers. In terms of salary, for example, what were teachers earning before the strike? How severe were your working conditions? And did things improve after the strike, Ana?
During the past 12 years, there hadn't been an increase to the basic salary of teachers in Puerto Rico. Before the strike, we were earning $1,500. With the threat of the strike alone, just the threat, there was a $100 increase granted to the base salary pay. And as part of the negotiations to end the strike, there was an additional $150. So right now in Puerto Rico, teachers are earning at the beginning level, $1,750.
A month.
Yes, that's a monthly salary. Teachers that, for instance, have longer time in the system, perhaps like 10, 15 years, are up to about $2,400 per month. And in terms of working conditions in Puerto Rico, one of the problems that we've had is that the Department of Education has deviated funds from the school to utilize for technological, what they call technological advances, money that was destined for books, for teaching materials, for, you know, the
chalkboard,
mm-hmm. the dry erase paper, toilet paper, mm-hmm. you name it. That money was deferred for the use of other systems. For instance, we have a punch system, a biometric time measurement system in Puerto Rico, which we are also fighting. So, you know, money has been taken from the schools and it has been placed in systems that have nothing to do with the educational process and, in fact, detract from the educational process, like that biometric system.
Meaning that people have to
We have to put our
fingerprint
yes.
to time in and
order,
out,
yes,
to punch in and out.
Yes, it's a time device system that we are fighting in the courts, and we also have a group of teachers that have been resisting using this system, and we're having a battle right now. Mm-hmm. Teachers are not being paid in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the class size condition, this was one of the reasons that we went on strike and that there was so much support.
What is a class size?
There are groups that have up to 40, 42, 43, 44. My sister taught a school, a 10th grade class with 47 students.
Mm. It's impossible.
It's impossible to educate with so many students. And that's one of the principal reasons that we went on strike and were supported by so many members of the community.
Now, the government decertified your union in retaliation for voting to strike. Was that legal? How has it affected your ability to carry out your tasks, Luis?
Okay, under Law 45, that's the labor law in Puerto Rico, the government could say that it's correct, no? But nothing stopped the teachers, no? The union does not come from a law. The union does not come from a paper. The union comes from the will of the people.
So
no?
The governor can just, as a single person, can just decertify an entire labor organization.
Okay. The law is so bad that in our case, before we went to the strike, just voting for the strike, mm-hmm. they could decertify you. No? That's the what the government could do. But nothing stopped us. The penalties did not stop us. The decertification did not stop us. The rompehuelgas, like we call them, did not stop us. The scabs. Mm-hmm. We went on to strike because the will of the teachers, the will of the workers cannot be stopped by a law.
How has that affected your ability to carry out your union task, Rafael?
Well, first of all, for us, the right to strike is a worker's right. Any law can the law can say that we don't have that right, but we have that right because we are not a slave, and we have the right to stop to work when we understand that we have it. The government make the decertification because they want to shut down our dues. And that was very difficult because the union was works for many months without any dues. The leadership don't have salary. And most of the work of the union was in a voluntary basis. That is very difficult, but it's very important. Money is not the principal factor to develop a strike. It's the voluntad, how you say?
Will.
The will of the people. Mm. The compromise of the people and the community to fight for better labor conditions, but also for a better educational condition for our students.
I want to remind our listeners, my guests are Rafael Feliciano Hernandez, the president of FMPR, the teachers union in Puerto Rico, also Luis Santiago, executive board member, and Ana Serrano, the vice president of the Aguadilla local of FMPR. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other factors at play in the union or around the union in Puerto Rico, which is that I understand that the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, has aligned with the governor of Puerto Rico, the person who decertified your union, and is planning on working to replace the FMPR with another union. Is this true? And if so, why would the SEIU do this?
Yes. Well, when we were in the strike, we were making negotiation for the new contract. And
this is after working without a contract for 30 months.
Exactly. Okay. In that moment, SEIU intervention was very bad because SAU supports the actual governor of Puerto Rico, Aníbal Acevedo Vilá, and they develop fundraisings for the reelection campaign of the governor. In that moment, Dennis Rivera fly from New York to Puerto Rico and meets with the governor and said that he cannot make a new contract with Puerto with Federación because they want to take to make a union busting against Federación, and if he make a new contract, he will not give the money for the reelection campaign. He have a compromise of $4 million for that campaign. Mm-hmm. That was terrible. But I want to say a little detail. We have to make a distinction between the leadership of SAU and the members of SAU. For example, in the convention,
Was held in Puerto Rico, exactly. The SAU convention.
Yes. We went to the convention center, and we have to fight with the police and with the SWAT teams of the police in Puerto Rico to be in the front of the building of the convention to give flyers to the stewards of the SAU. The governor make that order, and we have some of the teachers were beaten by the police and the special forces of the police. In the convention, most of the stewards of SAU supports Federación, and they say that is a shame what is doing the national leadership with the teachers in Puerto Rico. I think that we have to develop and to support the movement inside SAU for more democracy and for the empowerment of the workers of his own union. But in our strike, the intervention of the SAU was terrible.
So FMPR is working with this sort of a dissident movement within SEIU to try to reform the union, make it more democratic, etc. You're working with that movement?
Well, we have a communication with some of the leadership, and what we do is to support the movement for a real democracy and for the real empowerment for any union. But in this case, for the SAU movement that is fighting back to change the form of what the leadership is managing.
And is this issues. Because this is essentially FMPR is an independent union?
Well, I think that part of the reason why we're doing this is because our union has a very long tradition of participatory democracy, where a union with rank and file makes the decisions, and the leadership basically is the vehicle which carries out the will of the teachers. And all of the leadership is elected. Our leadership comes from the classroom. We have within our constitution articles which do not permit limitation of terms. So all of our leaders have to constantly go back to work in the classrooms, and we don't have people that are encrusted in leadership and at that tradition.
So sort of career unionist.
Yes. Uh-huh. And our salaries.
My salary is the same salary I have in the classroom.
Right.
You're not paid huge amounts.
No, yeah, all of our leadership maintains the salary of teachers. That's part of the commitment of the union to maintain rank and file as leaders, because we don't have a different class of leadership. Our leaders come from us. Mm. We're teachers, social workers, librarians that come into leadership of the union, and we go back to our posts within the schools and develop new leadership. And that kind of tradition is what has allowed our union leadership to maintain such a bond, because we're teachers and we're leaders, but we are the union. We are the union.
Why are you touring the U.S. mainland, and what sort of solidarity do you see from teachers here, you know, across the country, okay. Luis?
The situation of the Puerto Rican teachers is similar as the situation of the teachers here in the United States. For example, Rafael mentioned a little while ago, No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind is used to privatize you know, the education here and in Puerto Rico. And it's important that we have communication that our experience can be communicated to the teachers in the United States. But it's also important that we hear from them and see what is their experience. And it's important that they know what is the SEIU doing in Puerto Rico that supports a bus union, that is the Asociación de Maestros, that's the one that wants to challenge the Federación de Maestros. And also, it's important that in if they can also help us to fertilize our union, and let's be real honest, we're also in fundraising, no? Because the fundraising is necessary in this moment that the government is using everything against us. And
so you're really hurting for dues, and as you said, exactly. Salaries even of your leadership.
Remember, we developed a very hard strike. We need a time for a recovery. And the government make an alliance with some leaders of the SAU to make a joint efforts against Federación and against the teachers. That is it's a shame for the labor
Are you
movement.
Hearing from rank and file SEIU members?
Yes, we have contact with some leaders of the opposition sectors, and also we have a good relation with the rank and file members of SAU in Puerto Rico, because many times Federación support SAU in Puerto Rico, and we march with SAU. For us, was a very bad surprise to see how Dennis Rivera make an intervention directly against the teachers that we were on a strike. But I think that in this moment, what needs the Federación? Well, first of all, we need to share the information to break the isolation between the fights of the teachers in many places in the U.S. And it's very important to share the information. What happens in Puerto Rico? We will develop part of this tonight. But also, we need some economical support because we, in this moment, we are in the process of the recovery. And we need to develop a campaign to affiliate new members to recover the dues that we have before the strike.
I've been speaking with three members of the Federación de Maestros de Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico's Federation of Teachers and the largest independent union on the island. Rafael Feliciano Hernandez is the president of FMPR, Luis Santiago is its executive board member, and Ana Serrano is the vice president of the Aguadilla local of FMPR. For more information, you can visit fmprlucha.org. That's fmprlucha.org. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, I'd like to quote Frank Lloyd Wright, who once said, "If capitalism is fair, then unionism must be. If men have a right to capitalize their ideas and the resources of their country, then that implies the right of men to capitalize their labor." That's Frank Lloyd Wright, and that's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Our assistant producer is Gabriel San Roman. Our interns are Margaret Jo and Natalie Yar. We had engineering help from Teddy Robinson and Tamika Zogi. You can hear a podcast, listen to the audio stream, or download an MP3 of today's program at our website, uprisingradio.org. Just click on Weekly Programs. And you can email us at mail@uprisingradio.org. To order a CD of today's show, visit pacificaradioarchives.org or call 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Tune in next week for another edition of Uprising, and thanks so much for listening.